Once again, we find ourselves with a mass of information to try to survey. And if it's of any encouragement to you, the book of 2 Kings is probably the hardest for you to get a hold of, for any of us to get a hold of, simply because there are so many people involved and it covers such an extensive period of time with so much information about it. I'm not asking that you learn all of these kings. I do expect you to know some of the key ones that we're referring to, and I'll try to sample some of the key verses and the key turning points and the representative concepts as we find them listed throughout this book. Do try to keep this material located on the map. We have those little maps of the ministries of Elijah and Elisha. I would commend those to you to be able to follow around the events of their lives so that you can get kind of a feel for the context in which they live. Keep in mind that during most of this period, the big power was Assyria with a capital of Damascus. Syria. Syria with a capital of Damascus. Interestingly enough, it's covered just about the same territory as Syria covers today. The capital today, Damascus, is still there. It is reputed to be the oldest continuously inhabited city on the face of the earth, Damascus, very, very old. It was there when Abraham came down in 2000 B.C. from the east. And if you can identify the right people with the right governments and the right jobs, it's always kind of helpful. This man Naaman was the general of the Syrian army. He's not the kind of person that you'd expect would come for medical treatment to King Ahab's court. But God has wonderful ways of working, and one of the things that encourages me so much as I read through these passages is how when God is recording what happens to great nations and great movements, he'll come down and use this little servant girl to almost turn history around. He's interested in individual people, and he knows what goes on in their lives. And I kind of see over this whole thing Jesus' statement that he knows when the little sparrow falls, and that's the dimension I'd like you to see from of this. The story in chapter 5, the healing of Naaman, is very straightforward. He's the captain of the host of the king of Syria. He's a great man. He's an honorable man. He had a problem. He had leprosy. And in that day, this was an incurable disease. It was a disease that carried bad connotations with it. I don't want to get into the medical aspects of it at the moment, but certainly as far as they were concerned, it was a very bad thing. And the captive out of the land of Israel, a little maid, was waiting on Naaman's wife and said, there's somebody in Israel that can take care of this. And they got it worked out that he got the treatment from Elisha. But Elisha's prescription was an unusual one. He says, come on over here, and I want to dip you seven times. He wasn't a Baptist. I want to dip you seven times in the Jordan River. And he says, listen, we got better water that's not polluted back over in Damascus where I come from. And so the lesson here is obedience to the word of God, not rationalization. He would have been a leper till he died if he had not done what God told him to. This reminds me of Luke chapter 5. Luke chapter 5, in which Jesus said, put your nets down on the other side of the boat. Well, it didn't make any sense. Look, we've had them all over here. We've fished all night and have caught nothing. What difference does it make if we put them down? Then Peter said, he got the point. He said, nevertheless, at thy word, we will do it. And I guess that Naaman would say the same thing. It doesn't make any sense to me to go over there and get dipped in the Jordan River when we've got better water over where I come from. Nevertheless, at your word, I'll do it. The point is, the word of God is final and sovereign. And listen, the water wasn't any better in the Jordan River. And seven times didn't do it. But it was a visual aid of an internal spiritual issue. Authority. Doing it my way in Damascus or doing it God's way in the Jordan. That's all there is to it. Gehazi, the servant, tries to make a bit of money on it. One of the first times in the Old Testament we have graft and sticky fingers. And, Naaman says, what do I owe you? He says, nothing. Send me a bill. No, nothing. Down the road in Gehazi, he says, hey, we can make a bit of money off of this guy. You know, goes back and says, listen, no, we need a gift for that. A little bit of gift, you know. We're building a big cathedral, and we need a gift for that. Well, that was bad. Chapter 6. I guess the key word in this chapter is eyes or sight. very interesting that God, through Elisha, was giving intelligence to Ahab. He was giving information about where the enemy was. Talk about AWACS. Every place these Syrians moved, God knew ahead of time where they're going. And he told Elisha, and Elisha told Ahab. Finally, they got the message. Hey, we go here and they're there. We go another place and they're there. Hey, they know what we're doing. They've got eyes. He said, we're going to go down and take care of this spy, this informant. And so, as you know, they go down after Elisha and they catch him down there in the plain of Dothan. Who else got caught in the plain of Dothan? Joseph, right. Same place. Goes down there and the servant's afraid of all this mass. Look at all these people. We're in big trouble now. And here's a beautiful thing if you get discouraged. Elisha said, listen, you've only seen half of it. You want to see the other half? God opened his eyes and their eyes are open, and they not only see the physical military strength of Syria, which is threatening them, but they see for just an instant of time the whole host of heaven and all the angels arrayed on their side. Now, if it weren't for the fact that God wanted us to walk by faith, this would be a nice thing to happen today. Say, Lord, just for about 10 seconds, could you let me see my guardian angel? I'd just like to shake wings with him and just see what he looks like. Just take a look. God says, look, you don't have to see them. They're there. Just take my word for it. But on this particular occasion, he let them look. And he could see the whole host of heaven. And after that, he wasn't afraid. Take courage from that. They're there. Whether you see them or not is not the issue. God has them for protection. And just to kind of carry through on this a little bit, he blinded the eyes of all of the Syrians, this great host. And whereas he had just had special sight to see God's host, now the Syrians are blinded, and they lead them into the city, into Ahab, the whole host. They're blinded. They can't do anything about it. So it's kind of an interesting situation. In chapter 6, verse 24, we find the siege of Samaria. There are going to be several sieges of Samaria. And you remember I mentioned that Samaria is in a very impregnable situation. The reason that Syria was sieged so many times is that it was almost impossible to take by an outright attack. It was on that coffee cup upside down, you know, or teacup upside down. You could look around on all sides as you still can today, and they could see any enemy coming, and they had walls around it, and the most that the enemy could do is to just sit around there and wait till they starved them out, because there's no way you could take that city. You just had to starve them out. As a matter of fact, in 722 B.C., when finally the northern kingdom fell and Samaria fell, it was after a three-year siege. They were around there for 3 years before it fell. Anyway, this got really bad. It got so bad that the people were eating their children. Terrible thing. Can you imagine killing a child and eating your own child? And Elisha has a good word for them at the beginning of chapter 7. He says, listen, this time tomorrow, food's going to be back to its old prices. Can you imagine how much food cost in those days? Cost of living? Sure went sky high when they had no food after a long time. They couldn't go out to get their crops. They had only the food that was left. They would ration it. They'd fight over it. Their nerves would be frayed. They'd eat their own children. Finally, Elisha comes up one morning and he says, listen, tomorrow it's going to be okay. Food's going to be back to its normal prices. Well, that was quite a prophecy. And then this famous story about the four lepers that were sitting out at the gate. What chance do you think a leper had of getting food if they're killing, healthy people were killing their own children to eat? Do you think they'd feed the lepers? The lepers were back. They said, listen, we're going to die here. Let's go over to the Syrians. At least ask them. More chance over there. I'm so thankful for these four desperate lepers. This is one of the famous stories you've heard preached on several times, I'm sure, but it's just an exciting story. They go over to the camp of the Syrians. And lo and behold, the Syrians aren't there. God has frightened them. As a matter of fact, at verse 6 of chapter 7, it says, the Lord made the host of Syrians to hear a noise of chariots. They heard noises. Brum, 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 brum. Hey, here they come. I don't know where they thought they got the church. They said, hey, they've brought in, the king of Israel has brought in against us the Hittites and the Egyptians. He's got help, and here come these mercenaries. We better run before we get beaten. And so they ran off. They left all their food there. And the lepers come in, and man, here's more food in the commissary than they ever knew what to do with. And they got a problem. What do they do with it? In verse 9, mark it carefully. They said to one another, We do not well. This day is a day of good tidings, and we hold our peace. If we tarry until the morning light, some mischief will come upon us. Now therefore come that we may go and tell the king's household. Listen, we've got the food. They're starving back there. They're killing their children. They're dying of hunger. And we've got the food. And we're only four lepers, but we better go back and tell them. And we better not wait till next morning. We better go right now. It's urgent that they find out. Now, if you don't get a message out of that, I'm not going to tell you what it is. But this is the message of evangelism. We've got the food. And lepers, you know, you say, well, I'm not good enough. I'm not a great speaker, and I'm not a very famous person. And, well, who were the lepers? They're at the lower end of the totem pole. But when those lepers got back to Samaria and said, there's food out there, do you think they said, we're not going to listen to you because you're lepers? Their message was so important that they got listened to. And our message is pretty important. Chapter 7, then, a very interesting chapter. And in verse 16, we find that the prophecy of verse 1 is fulfilled. Chapter 8, we find Elisha predicting that Hazael, who was a general, or at least an aide to King Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, the great enemy, predicting that he was going to be the next king of Syria. Now remember back in 1 Kings 19:15, when Elijah was down there at Mount Sinai, you remember how the Lord spoke to him and he said, you are going to anoint Elisha as your successor, and you're going to anoint Hazael, and you're going to anoint Jehu. There's no record that Elijah himself personally anointed Hazael. He may have done so. But it is also possible that the reference there was the fact that his successor was going to do it. In other words, we find this sometimes in Scripture, that a person is said to do it when in his lifetime it doesn't get happen, but it gets done as a result of something that he has done. So whichever way it happened, the word comes through Elisha in verse 13, the Lord hath showed me that thou shalt be king over Syria. There's a parallel here because a leader under Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, is to take his place. And who's the other one they were to prophesy about? Jehu. Jehu was the general of the Israeli army, the Israel army, and he was to take the place of his king, Ahab. So in both Syria and Israel, the northern kingdom, you had the situation where the ruler was to be replaced by the head of his army. Things haven't changed much in the last few years, you know, over this period of time. Except this was in God's plan that it should happen. Chapter 9, we find this second part of the parallel that I just mentioned, namely that Jehu is going to be appointed to take over the house of Ahab. That is, he's to conquer the house of Ahab. This is one of the bloodiest scenes in all of the Old Testament. Because as you read through there, you find that Jehu, in chapters 9 and 10, wiped out the house of Ahab. Of course, you and I know that it had been a long time coming. Ahab had been an evil man down through his years. Jezebel had just torn things up and down. If anybody had it coming, it was Ahab. I guess the only question we'd ask is not why did it happen, but why didn't it happen sooner? I don't know if it was intended as humor or not, but it certainly has been taken in, with a humorous application about how Jehu used to drive. And see, Jehu was over in Ramoth-Gilead, over where they've been fighting. Ramoth-Gilead was more or less half, not on a direct line, but more or less halfway between Damascus and Samaria. And they used to fight the battles over in Ramoth-Gilead. That was kind of the battleground over there. And so after the last defeat of Syria, the general Jehu was still over there. And that's where Elisha goes and finds him. And he says, okay, now you go on back, and God has said that you're to go back and take over from Ahab. Apparently he didn't need much encouragement. He didn't drag his feet on it. Literally, he didn't drag his feet. And he gets in his chariot, and he comes tearing back over. And they're up on the walls of Jericho. Of course, the watchman's always up there. The Syrian's coming. Who's coming? And brum, brum, brum. They see the dust coming in the distance. They say, who is it? Can't tell. Too far away. Who does it look like? Oh, he's driving like Jehu. It must be Jehu. Nobody drives like that. So Jehu was known for how he drove his chariot. And he came up and, among other things, He says, he gets there and he says, Jezebel, time has come. Jezebel's up in her apartment and he wants her to come down. She's going to be executed in verse 30. She wants to be ready for it. When Jehu was come to Jezreel, Jezebel heard of it. She painted her face and tired her head. That is, she had a coiffure, you know, she got her hair dressed, and looked out the window. And the servant threw her out, and she was killed. And in verse 36, the dogs ate her flesh. The fulfillment of that prophecy of Elijah. And then in verse 10 of chapter 10, an interesting verse, know now that there shall not fall unto the earth, that there shall fall unto the earth nothing of the word of the Lord which the Lord spake concerning the house of Ahab, for the Lord hath done that which he spake by his servant Elijah. If you're living in that time under wicked Ahab and evil, conniving Jezebel, you would say, how long, O Lord, how long? Why is it that the wicked prosper? But as the saying goes, the wickedness of the Amorites was not yet full. The wickedness of Ahab and Jezebel was not yet full. But when it came full, God's prediction took place, and that line was ended. Jehu was the first of a dynasty of five, which was relatively long in the northern kingdom. There were four to succeed him. He was a good fighter, but he wasn't all that great an administrator. But what he did do is exterminate Baal worship in Israel. We have that in chapter 10. And he's promised that there are going to be four generations. Verse 30 of chapter 10, thy children of the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel. But Jehu took no heed to walk in the law of the Lord God of Israel with all his heart. For he departed not from the sins of Jeroboam. Remember that phrase? The sins, the way of Jeroboam, which made Israel to sin. I guess looking at it from a human standpoint, we would almost have to say that things were very desperate in the northern kingdom when God had to use such poor instruments as Jehu. Jehu was a good general. He knew how to kill Ahab. He knew how to kill Jezebel. He knew how to wipe out their family. He knew how to take charge. But he didn't know how to walk with God. He didn't know how to lead them spiritually. And this is something that's lacking throughout the whole northern kingdom. There was no spiritual leadership. No spiritual leadership. And that is why you have so many prophets sent to the northern kingdom, because the only spiritual voice from God came not from the kings, as he had intended, but came from the prophets. Most famous of all his line, of course, was Jeroboam the second, and it was during his reign that that Jonah prophesied. In chapter 11, I'm sure you've read the history of this. We don't need to take a lot of time on it. But in chapter 11, in the southern kingdom, the line of the tribe of Judah, that is the royal line of David, I should say, was almost wiped out. Athaliah was apparently a daughter of Jezebel. And she took the throne. She tried to wipe out all the heirs, and she took the throne for about 6 or 7 years. There was one little guy, one little baby she hadn't killed. Boy, that's coming pretty close to wiping out the line of David, isn't it? That was a close one. And can you imagine the daughter of Jezebel and Ahab on the throne of David? How things had sunk. But I think one reason that God let this happen was to show that he was still in control. And it would have been just as easy as to kill all those children, all those babies. But God preserved one. And there was one that was just a year old. When 6 years had passed by and that child was 7 years old, the high priest moved in and he took certain action by faith. He laid his life on the line. And he got that little seven-year-old baby, or infant rather, crowned king. And Athaliah heard about it, and she was put to death, and the monarchy there was saved. She was executed. This man, of course, was Jehoash, or Joash, and we read about him in chapter 12. Now, we're going to skip over chapters 12 to 15 because there's interesting information in them, but this is the record of various kings of Judah and of Israel. I want to move on to chapter 16, to Ahaz. If you have not discovered in Leon Wood, if you've not discovered the timeline, the time charts, I highly commend them to you. In the back of the book, they start following page 417. You don't have to look at it now, but this will help sort out these people immensely. I don't know if they have them in the bookstore now, but Moody Press has a series of these things on laminated card, the board that you can, they actually all, there's a book of them of various timelines and charts. You may want to check into that, or you may want to Xerox this and put it in your notebook, but it's very, very helpful to have this. They are put out in various forms. Grace Seminary with Dr. Whitcomb has quite a set of these charts you can open out. And this isn't a question of memorizing, it's just any more than when you go on a trip, you don't memorize all the roads and all the highways and all the villages, but at least you get an idea of where the thing is going in a sense of proportion and relationship to the other towns and states and so on. And that's what I'm asking you to do, is get a sense of proportion of relationship of how these things go. You'll notice, incidentally, that the line zigs and zags on these. And the reason for this is regency. Almost every king had his son put on the throne before he died. In other words, while he was still strong enough to do it. You can't imagine the reason for that. Because if you had a young son, or even just any kind of a son, and you waited until you died, and he wasn't on the throne and established there, it was very, very doubtful if he would get to establish the throne. This was a very violent time, and there were a lot of people who were trying to get the authority, get the power of these thrones. And so the common custom was for one man to put his son on the throne. In fact, one of them, while he was still a regent, that is, on the throne while his father was still alive, while he was still a regent, he had his son put on. So that was kind of an overlapping regency. But they're playing it very, very safe. Anyway, Ahaz is one of the very evil kings of Israel. And he is important for a couple of reasons. Ahaz was on the throne at the time of the Assyrian invasion in which they took the northern kingdom. Now, this map does not show the where these nations were, but you can check this on one of your other maps or in your atlas. You remember that Assyria was in this area up between the rivers. The capital of Assyria was Nineveh. Nineveh is on the Tigris River up here. Can you see that all right? Tigris River up here, as you're aware. Between Assyria, which was growing in power, and Israel, the northern kingdom down here, was Syria. Now, Syria, as we've seen for generations, had been the enemy of the northern kingdom. And so, and the northern kingdom, for most of the time, was also the enemy of the southern kingdom. And so, if you're Ahaz in the southern kingdom, you are going to perceive that your best friend would be Assyria. Because if you could, that is after Syria took over the northern kingdom. Because these countries up here were a danger to you, and you saw as a potential friend Assyria up in the north. And so right after the Syrians came in and took over the northern kingdom, Ahaz got to be very strong friends with Assyria that was growing over here. Now, eventually, Assyria is going to come in and take over these. But I shouldn't say Syria took over the northern kingdom, but Syria was an enemy of the northern kingdom over here. However, they had the common enemy of Assyria. So the thing to remember, one thing to remember about Ahaz is that he was very pro-Assyrian. Very pro-Assyrian. He saw the Assyrians as the great potential help for the southern kingdom. Now, what he didn't realize is that Assyria was going to come in and conquer both Syria and the northern kingdom. That's what he didn't realize. And cross-reference in this would be Isaiah chapter 7. Because in Isaiah chapter 7, Isaiah, who's prophesying at the time of Ahaz, says, Ahaz, you think that your enemy is the northern kingdom and Syria. It's not. They're nothing. They're going to be wiped out, snuffed out like candles. Your big enemy is the people that you think is your friend up there. Yes, sir. What Syrians want to come down here because of this? There is a flow here, a power flow throughout most of, well, we'll say for the 1,500 years before Christ, a power flow from the Mesopotamian Valley down here to Egypt. And as great peoples would become strong in here, they would want to expand down, and Egypt was always on the other end of the axis. They were always after Egypt. They always headed down for Egypt. So that Israel just happened to be in the way. Of course, they were popular kings too. I mean, they were well-known and powerful kings too. And of course, these people could remember Solomon. They could remember Jeroboam II that had land all the way up to the Euphrates River. So they saw them as enemies in their own right. But it's been this way all the way down through history as Satan has deceived the nations, that he's always wanted to make nations to get more and more power. We've seen it, you know, anything about European history, you know, it just constantly boiling over, trying to get more and more power. Well, in those days, it was the power struggle was from here, and they'd move around the Fertile Crescent down through here, and they'd take Syria, they'd take the northern kingdom, and as we will see, they came down and they threatened the very gates of Jerusalem. They took everything around here. They took the Philistia. They moved down here against Egypt. In fact, they never took Egypt because the Egyptians were too strong, and they gave them a bit of a hassle, but they kind of got stopped here. But as it turned out, that when the Assyrians moved down through here in 722 and the years following, the high water mark was 701, because in 701, Sennacherib came up against the walls of Jerusalem, the time of Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, and he said, give in, give us some tribute, give us a token that you're going to let us in, because you're done for. Now, that's how thin the thread of independence of Jerusalem was in that day. And then the tide moved back, and we see that Babylon became strong, and then the Persians and others. Does that answer your question? Okay. In chapter 16, then, we have the reign of Ahaz, and in verse 7, you see illustrated what I was mentioning. Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am thy servant and thy son. Come up and save me out of the hand of the king of Syria and out of the hand of the king of Israel. There it is. And you read that in connection with Isaiah 7, and you'll see that Isaiah is saying, look, you've got the wrong end of the stick. This is completely reversed. And then in 17, we find that the Assyrians come down and finally take Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom. In verse 6, in the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away into Assyria and placed them in Hala and in Habor by the river of Gozan and so on in the cities of the Medes. Now, I'm sure you've had it pointed out to you before, but it's a very important point in history at this stage to realize that each nation, when it took over another nation, had the problem of how to control it. It was one thing to win the battle. It was another thing to control the other nation. And there were different theories as to how this should be done. I'm going to give you these three just right now because they'll help us from now on. The Assyrians' modus operandi was that when you go in and take a nation, you take many of the people from that nation and spread them among other peoples you've conquered and interchange them with the people you've conquered from other places. In other words, you mix the people. If you conquer countries A, B, C, and D, when you conquer E, you move the people of E and spread them amongst A, B, C, and D, and you move some samples of A, B, C, and D into E. That's for the geometry majors. I don't know if that's good or not. But that was their way of doing it. More or less our phrase, divide and conquer. Because the idea behind it is that it wouldn't have any national entity. They wouldn't have any sense of cohesiveness if they mixed them up like that. Now, the second theory on it was the Babylonians, who come later. The Babylonians say, no, that's a dumb way to do it. The Babylonians say, here's how you should do it. What you do is you take some of their key leaders, some of their bright young men, some of their administrators, and take them back and educate them and train them to be your administrators. That's why Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, Daniel were taken back to Babylon. Because when Nebuchadnezzar conquered Israel, when he conquered Judah and conquered Jerusalem, he did that in 606, he didn't want to destroy it. He didn't want to replace the people. He wanted all the people of the land to stay right where they were, but he was going to send them administrators, and he was pretty smart because he thought, if I can administer through them all, through their own people, then I'll have a hold on them. In other words, they won't be foreign rulers. They'll be puppets, but I'll control them. That was the Babylonian way. The Persian way was really not a third way, except that it followed the other two, and so it reversed them. The Persians said, what you've got to do is be friends with the gods of the other people. It was a theological approach. They said, you've got to be friends with their gods. So when you conquer a people, make sure that you honor their gods. And so when the Persians conquered the Babylonians and the people of Israel were over there in Babylon, King Cyrus made a decree that all the people who were conquered could go back to their own lands and they should take their gods back with them. A little bit embarrassing for the Jews because they didn't have any gods. They'd left all their, quote, gods on the hillsides and around Jerusalem. But all they had was the golden goblets and the things from the temple. So they took those back. But that was the Persian approach. But right now we're interested in the Assyrians because... And this is interesting because it was God's purpose that he would take the people off the land if they didn't obey him. We've seen that all the way from the Palestinian covenant, right? He says, you obey me and you can stay in the land. You disobey me, I'm going to take you off the land. He sent the prophets for about 300 years to warn them, if you don't give up this idolatry, I'm going to take you off the land. So finally, in 722, he sends the Assyrians, whose policy it is to take people off the land. He sent them to take the people off the land. I want you to see how the sovereign God sends the right people at the right time to work in the right way to accomplish his purpose. But he only let them take the people of the northern kingdom, and he preserved the kingdom of Judah. They weren't allowed to touch Judah. 722, they took everybody but Judah. Why? He wants to maintain Judah where the royal line was, as an entity. He wants to maintain its integrity. Now to look down in history a little bit, he brings on the Babylonians. The Babylonians knock off the Assyrians, and the Babylonians come in, and it was their original purpose to leave the people of Judah in Judah. But unfortunately, they rebelled, and they wouldn't pay their taxes, and they kept acting up until finally, after coming over twice to try to put them in their place, Nebuchadnezzar lost his patience, gave up, came over in 586. He wipes out the city of Jerusalem and takes all that are left over to Babylon. Against his better judgment, against his own druthers, he takes them over to Babylon. But even in so doing, he takes them over together. And I want you to notice, when he takes them, he doesn't spread them around. He takes them down to a concentration camp on the channel, the canal called Kibar, which is a channel, a canal between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Very flat country. You know what they call the name of the place? Tel Aviv. You ever heard of Tel Aviv? That is the name of the place. Read about Ezekiel. Tel Aviv. Spelled with B's instead of V's, but it's Tel Aviv. So they put them at Tel Aviv in the land of Babylon. They didn't bring them into the city of Babylon. They had a big concentration camp for them. And then when the time came that the Persians came in by God's sovereign design, in 539 they knocked off the Babylonians and they said, okay, you can go home now. So here is an entity. Here is an identifiable group. which have maintained their integrity and their togetherness, if you please, their racialness. They haven't been scattered. They haven't been intermixed. And they come back, 50,000 of them, back to the city of Jerusalem and settle the area and stay there, so that 500 years later, when Jesus is born of the royal line, there are Jews living in Jerusalem and in Bethlehem and in Galilee, so that he can move ahead with God's program. Now, I hope I haven't lost you somewhere back there between the bricks, the stones. You get that sequence? It's very important that the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Persians dealt with their conquered people differently. And we're just at the beginning edge of this thing. We're just starting off with the Assyrians. Yes? Assyrians I'm talking about. Assyrians. Right. Okay, I'll run back. Those dates are actually in a chart in your notes. But the key dates are these. The northern kingdom fought... Well, okay. The Assyrians take Damascus. That is, they take over Syria in 732. That's the first of the sequence. 732, Assyrians knock out Syria. 10 years later, 722, Assyrians knock out northern kingdom. In parenthesis, in 701, 21 years later, another ruler comes down of the Assyrians and almost knocks out Jerusalem, but doesn't. We've got to get to that today. The next key date is 612, which is 100 years, almost 100 years later. 612, the Babylonians have become strong enough to destroy Nineveh. Nineveh was the capital of Assyria. This is fun when you get all the, you know, names and players together, the people together. In 612, the Babylonians destroy Nineveh, which incidentally is described in the book of Nahum. And they destroy Nineveh. Now, the Babylonians are strong, and they come down, and in 606 or 605 B.C., they take control of Palestine, but they don't do anything bad to it. They don't destroy it or anything. And then for the next 20 years or so, there's this hassle back and forth with the descendants of Josiah until finally in 586, sometimes it's given as 587, 587, 586, Jerusalem is destroyed. And the last of the people are taken over to Babylon. The next key event, the Persians become strong and they knock out the Babylonians, in 539 B.C. And that is Daniel chapter 5. You ever heard of Belshazzar's feast? Belshazzar's feast, the writing on the wall, you're weighed and weighed and found wanting. That's when the Persians knocked out the Babylonians, 539. And the decree of Cyrus came right after that. It took about 3 years before they get all cranked up to get back there. But the decree of Cyrus then came and said, you can go back. And they went back and they got back in 536 B.C. Now you keep those dates in mind and all of this will make a whole lot more sense. But listen, we've got to finish up 2 Kings here in the next few minutes. Although this is, you know, good background to it. In chapter 17 then is the end of the northern kingdom. Chapter 18, the reign of Hezekiah. I also commend to you 2 Chronicles chapters 29 to 31. 2 Chronicles chapter 29 and 31, you'll find a lot more detail on this. The prophet of Hezekiah's time was Isaiah. It'll help you if you link Isaiah with Hezekiah and Jeremiah with Josiah. Now, there's a reason for that. Isaiah was the strong voice for God at the time of Hezekiah. He actually prophesied through 4 kings' reigns, but Hezekiah in particular. And he backed up Hezekiah when the Syrians, after having taken the northern kingdom, were coming down and about to crush the southern kingdom, and Isaiah encouraged Hezekiah. Hezekiah had a great revival. There's several things to notice. He had a great revival in verses 4 to 7. Verse 7, the Lord was with him, and he prospered whatever he did. Starting at chapter 18, verse 13, you've got the Assyrians now coming against, they've taken all of Judah, that is, they've taken all of the fortified cities like Libna and Lachish and so on. They've wiped out the Philistines. Now, in verse 17, they come up to Jerusalem, and they make fun of Jerusalem, and they say, and at one time Sennacherib says that Hezekiah is like a bird in a cage. We got him trapped. And they threaten them. And they send a letter of threatening. And Hezekiah, in this famous passage in chapter 19, he lays the letter out before the Lord and says, what will we do? And the Lord, through Isaiah, says, God is not going to allow the city to be taken. Verse 6, Isaiah said, be not afraid. They're going to be conquered. And God wiped out the Assyrians in chapter 19, verse 35. It came to pass that night that the angel of the Lord went and smote the camp of the Assyrians, and Sennacherib dies. Two last things in chapter 20 of Hezekiah's reign. He was sick, and he asked that the Lord would give him some more years, and the Lord turned back his clock, so to speak, and he was given 15 more years of life. The only time in history it's ever happened. But listen, there's a lesson in this. If he had died then, he wouldn't have made a very foolish mistake. But in the last 15 years of his life, Hezekiah was really on top of it. He was euphoric. I've been given extra life. Sennacherib didn't take the city. Everything's going great. There are some visitors, you say? Yes. Where are they from? Well, his name is Merodach Baladan. He is from Babylon. Oh, show them in. Babylon. That's a country over in the east somewhere, isn't it? Yes, over in the east. Never heard of them very much, but send them in. Glad to have you here. Hey, would you like to see my treasures? Come on in and see my treasures. He takes them through the vaults and shows them his treasures and so on to these representatives of Babylon. At that time, Babylon was no more important in their thinking than just a small country. It was nothing. But they never forgot the treasures they saw. And it wasn't many years later than the Babylonians came over and took those same treasures back to Babylon. As far as we're concerned, by hindsight, we could almost wish that he had died. Of course, it wouldn't change history, but it's an interesting thought. His son was a bad one. Manasseh reigned 52 years, one of the worst of all of the kings. And that brings us on to the last really good king in chapters 22 and 23, Josiah. Josiah had a tremendous revival during his days. They didn't even know where the Bible was, and they went into the temple and they found the scriptures that it had dust on them, and they hadn't read for years, and they brought out these scriptures. And Josiah delayed the judgment of God coming a little bit. During his time, Jeremiah prophesied, but we don't find Jeremiah mentioned too much because God is speaking through Josiah, but as soon as Josiah dies, then we find Jeremiah speaking more. And Jeremiah's message was just one message, and that is, God is going to send the Babylonians to take Jerusalem. Don't try to defend it. Don't try to defend it. It's too late. I'd suggest you read Jeremiah chapter 25. Jeremiah chapter 25. So Hezekiah had Isaiah to strengthen his hand against the Assyrians. Josiah had Jeremiah to tell the people the truth, that judgment was coming and it was too late to avert it. And Josiah made a fatal mistake because Josiah, when he saw the king of Egypt going up to help the Assyrians, he thought that this was going to be a problem. He didn't realize, or help the Babylonians rather, he thought that the Babylonians were his friends. He didn't know that they were going to be the future enemies. So again, he got the wrong end of the stick. He went up onto the plain of Megiddo. You remember Megiddo? That important, you know where that is in a minute. He went up to Megiddo to try to cut off Pharaoh Necho coming up from Egypt, and he lost his life. And Pharaoh Necho went on up and had this great battle of Carchemish, the second battle of Carchemish, and Nebuchadnezzar won it and came with the Babylonians down, and from 606 on, the Gentiles controlled Jerusalem. You must remember that Jeremiah began his prophecy at least this recorded prophecy, about the time that Josiah was killed. Josiah was killed in 609 B.C. Jeremiah was around before that, but as noted earlier, it appears that Josiah was doing such an excellent job as king and being used by God for all kinds of reforms and so on, that Jeremiah's ministry did not become prominent until after Josiah the king was killed. But then Jeremiah had the, I guess, the most unenviable task of any of the prophets. He had to be in Jerusalem during the time when Nebuchadnezzar was threatening, when the city was to fall, and he had to tell the people, don't defend the city, judgment's coming on the city will fall. And of course, that was a very unpopular message. They said, no, God is going to defend us. He's not going to let that temple of Solomon be knocked down. He's not going to let our city be wiped out. No way. Jeremiah says, yes, if you resist, it will be destroyed. But if you don't resist and let it come as a judgment of God, the city and the temple won't be destroyed. And then, of course, just as Jeremiah had predicted, the forces of Babylon did come in, and in 586, they did wipe out the city, and Jeremiah stayed there, and Nebuchadnezzar knew that Jeremiah was a good man. He knew that he had told the truth, that he had been on the right side of things. He respected him, and he wanted to take him back to Babylon. But Jeremiah said, no, I'm going to stay with the people. And they set up governor, Gedaliah. And Gedaliah was assassinated by some of the Jews who stayed. And as a result of that, they had to flee. And virtually everybody who was left in the country then in Judah, and there weren't many of them left, and they were really the poor of the land that were left, because, you know, so many had been taken off. Then they fled down to Egypt of all places, and they took Jeremiah with them. So Jeremiah had a very, very miserable task. No wonder he's called a weeping prophet. He had more to weep about than all the rest of the prophets put together, I guess. Now, the reason I give that background is to see that in the prophecy of Jeremiah, written at the time, pretty much at the time that Nebuchadnezzar takes control of Jerusalem in 606, he didn't destroy it, he didn't do anything to it then except to take away Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel to train them to be governors, that's all. There was no pressure at all. He was going to take them away, and he was going to train them, and he was going to leave everything in place. He was just going to collect tribute, collect taxes, which was their usual procedure when they conquered a people. Now, about that time, Jeremiah, in Jeremiah 25, explains what's going on. And he says in verse 4, "The Lord hath sent unto you all his servants and the prophets, rising early and sending them, but you have not hearkened nor inclined your ear to hear." Now, the prophets he's referring to here are all of the, virtually all of the prophets. Some went to the northern kingdom, of course, like Hosea and Amos. But he's talking about Habakkuk. He's talking about Zephaniah. He's talking about Isaiah. All of these prophets that went to the southern kingdom, but he could also include those that went to the northern kingdom because they had the same message several generations before that. The only prophets that aren't included there would be Ezekiel and Daniel, who wrote during the exile, and Haggai and Zechariah and Malachi, who wrote after the exile. They're called the post-exilic prophets. So you subtract the exilic prophets, Ezekiel and Daniel, and the post-exilic prophets of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, and he's talking about all the other prophets when he says the prophets have warned you. And they have said, in verse 5, "Turn you again now, every one from his evil way and from the evil of your doings, and dwell in the land that the Lord hath given unto you and to your fathers forever and ever. Go not after other gods," and so on. But he says, "You didn't hearken." Verse 7, "You provoke me to anger with the works of your hands to your hurt." Verse 9, "Behold, I will send and take the families of the north, saith the Lord, and Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant." Now, he calls him his servant because he's doing his work. He's accomplishing his purposes. You'll find this in several places in the Old Testament. Cyrus, for instance, in Isaiah chapters 44 and 45, Cyrus is called my servant Cyrus. And here it's my servant Nebuchadnezzar. And they're servants of God because God is using them to bring about the things he wants to accomplish in his plan. And he said, "I'll utterly destroy them and make them an astonishment and hissing and perpetual desolations."
You'll find that element of shame quite often in the predictions of what God does in taking the people off the land. You see, it had been such a marvelous, miraculous, big thing for them to take over the land, an historic event. Everybody knew about it because Moses had led them through the Red Sea dry shot, and the whole Egyptian army had been drowned. They'd never heard of anything like that. And then they'd come across the Jordan River. And before that, they'd defeated Sihon and Og, and that scared the wits out of the people in Jericho. Then they'd come in, and the walls of Jericho had fallen down. And then they had chased all those kings down through and killed all those kings, hung them up by the thumbs. You remember all that down at Makkah and so on, in that central campaign and southern campaign? And then they went up the north. And whoever heard of Jabin, the king of Hazor? 200 acres of city, Hazor. Joshua burned it. And when you think of the events that had taken place, and then Solomon's temple and Solomon's city and the extent of Solomon's kingdom, and how people like the Queen of Sheba and others came in and marveled at him and said, the half was never told. You get a picture of what God had done for the people in the land and what a witness that was to the kind of God that he was. Then you come to the place where the Assyrians come in and take all of the northern tribes. And Nebuchadnezzar comes in and takes the tribe of Judah that's left, destroys Jerusalem, and burns the temple. You've got a situation that was known internationally as a situation of shame. That's why we find even this word hissing used. You know how we would hiss and make fun of somebody and ridicule somebody. Now, we don't do that as adults, but little kids do that, you know. Shame on you. Look what happened. You thought you could do this, and you thought you're big stuff, and so on. That's it. Hissing. And perpetual desolations. Astonishment. There are a lot of other words that are used in connection with this. That was the situation of 586. It shook up the whole world scene when you consider what it was coming from. Moreover, I will take from them the voice of mirth, the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom, the voice of the bride, the sound of the millstones and the light of the candle. No marriage. The most joyous time in all of Jewish life was at a marriage, dancing. The voice of the bride, the sound of the millstone. You might not like to hear the grinding in the morning, but what you don't hear grinding, when you don't hear grinding, it means there's no food. The sound of the millstone meant there was food. So there's to be no food. And the light of the candle. No Jewish home would ever go without having a candle. If there's a home without a light in it at night, it meant death. That nobody was there. There was no life there. And they kept the candle burning, the light burning. And so when the lights go out, it speaks of death in their culture. And then verse 11, these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. And it shall come to pass that when the 70 years are accomplished, that I will punish the king of Babylon, that nation, the land of the Chaldeans. I'll make it perpetual desolations. I'm going to bring somebody in to wipe them out. And so God has it all planned. And this is all given to Jeremiah in 606 B.C., long before the destruction of Jerusalem, and long before Cyrus comes in and at Belshazzar's feast knocks down the Babylonian Empire in 539 B.C. So it's quite an event. It's quite a prophecy. Before I forget it, I would recommend that you read the last part of Isaiah 44 and the first few verses of Isaiah 45. They predict 150 years before the event, they predict the time that Cyrus comes in and takes the city of Babylon. And there's even a reference there that indicates how he's going to do it, coming up the river valley and coming under the walls and taking it from the inside. I would encourage you to read Leon Wood, even though it's not assigned. It won't take you very long. I'd encourage you to read Leon Wood on this whole matter of the exile and the return. It'll help you get a lot of things sorted out, the various kings of Babylon. You're not asked to memorize them, but you'll find that sometimes there's an assassination and a general or somebody in the household will take over, or a relative. Sometimes it's a son that takes over and he's killed or whatever. These people just don't go like George the First, George the Second, George the Third, right down the line. It's more complicated. So when you see a name of a king of a dynasty, it doesn't mean that he's necessarily the son of that person. He may be the general that came in and took over. And then the five Persian kings that we'll pick up a little bit later. All right, look in your notes, if you will, please, now in 1 and 2 Chronicles. We're not going to in any way go through these books, even to skip through hardly as we've done in other books. But what I want you to get is the thrust of what the book of 1 and 2 Chronicles is about. They're qualitative. These books are qualitatively different as histories from 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. The first thing to notice, just in a general helicopter way, is that you started 1 Samuel with what person and what period? Samuel, actually Eli, and then Samuel at the end of the period of the Judges, right? And you end 2 Kings at what? Zedekiah, the last king of Judah, being taken off to Babylon. So those four historical books, as we have them divided in our Bibles, from 1 Samuel through to 2 Kings, form a continuous sequence. It's just a sequence from point A to point Z, as far as the kingdom is concerned. From the last of the judges to the last of the kings, right through in a sequence. Now, you probably always wondered about 1 and 2 Chronicles, but you never wanted to ask. But I'm going to tell you that 1 and 2 Chronicles does not go through in a sequence from point A to point B. It neither continues from the end of 2 Kings, nor does it go back over all of the material exactly. What it is, it's we might call a stylized, or that's not a good word maybe, but a stylized, it's a pair of books. It's an interpretation, that's a good word. It's an interpretation of the monarchy of Judah, not the northern kingdom, but it's an interpretation of the establishment of the monarchy for a very special reason. So the theme is a post-exilic interpretive history. It's written after the exile. It's written after the exile. Now, these books are written by Ezra. And Ezra wasn't on the scene until some 70, 80 years after the people came back from Babylon. So this is really post-exilic. The exile was all finished by this time. Anybody could go back from Babylon who wanted to. If they didn't go back, it's only because they didn't want to leave their business in downtown Babylon. That was all. They could go back. So the exile was over. But as it was over, there was a new situation, as we'll see. And therefore, it was important to have a couple of books written. Post-exilic interpretive history of the growth and development of priestly worship from the death of Saul to the end of the Babylonian captivity. So it's an interpretive history of the establishment of the monarchy with emphasis on the temple and worship and the priesthood. Emphasis on the temple and the priesthood and the worship, the temple. Now you've got to get into their sandals to see what's going on in that historical background. You'll notice it says the remnant had returned from Babylon. They'd come back. They'd built a temple. But things were far different. There were many, many differences, as we'll see. The books of Samuel had recorded the institution of the early stages of the monarchy. The books of Kings had recorded its rulers. The book of Chronicles, this should be the books of Chronicles, were written under an entirely new condition. Now, here's the three conditions. No king, no temple, no national capital. No king on David's throne. Zedekiah was the last one. No temple worship because they had no temple. That is when they first came back. And no national capital. You say, weren't they in Jerusalem? Yes, but what was Jerusalem? It was one city in the midst of what was left of Judea. And I haven't to this point mentioned what happened north of Jerusalem. I assume that most of you know that when the Assyrians took out the northern tribes, especially from Ephraim and Manasseh, that central area between Jerusalem and Mount Tabor, the Jezreel Valley there, when they took those tribes out, they brought other tribes in, and they from other places, they intermingled them, and they're called the Samaritans. Good. See, I didn't have to tell you. You knew all about that. The Samaritans. And these Samaritans controlled, they're just a mixed group of people. It was an amorphous thing. And they were simply, after the Persians took over, they were simply satrapies, or another word for province or regions or districts administered by the Persian emperor over there. So what I'm saying is there wasn't anything that resembled any kind of national situation at all. All they had was the city of Jerusalem with a little bit of land around it, and they're going to build a temple in it. So there's no king, there is no temple worship, and there's no nation. The reason for that was the times of the Gentiles. Now, the Lord Jesus uses the phrase, the times of the Gentiles, in Luke 21, 24, in the Olivet Discourse, Luke 21, 24. And the times of the Gentiles refers to that period of history in which there is no king of the Davidic line on the throne of David in Jerusalem. The times of the Gentiles is basically that period of time when there is no king of the line of David on the throne in Jerusalem. Now, in the absence of a king, who do you suppose becomes the de facto leader, the primary person, the high priest? The priests become important. So what we have in 1st and 2nd Chronicles is a sort of a second look at the monarchy with emphasis on the priesthood. You can see in the rest of that page, in the next page, that there are really, and this is your block out thing, this is your content thing that you don't have to do for the assignment, but it's there in diagram form. There are two sections of 1st Chronicles, two sections of 2nd Chronicles. It's really very simple. The first section, the first 10 chapters of 1 Chronicles, I have the main genealogies from Adam to Zedekiah. That's true, also with the tribes and their allotments. You don't have detail on this, but you've got some of the main tribes, like the tribe of Levi, for instance, is mentioned prominently. So 1 to 10 is genealogy. The rest of the book is, what do you expect? What comes next? 11 to 29? Monarchy with David. You've got David. You've got one little verse or so on Saul, just almost in passing before that, at the end of chapter 10. But in 11 to 29, you've got David. Two big divisions in 2 Chronicles. The first 9 chapters is about, guess who? Solomon. With big emphasis on the temple. And the rest of the book, from 10 to 36, is about the kings of Judah. Now, one advantage of studying especially 2 Chronicles, well, for that matter, the last part of 1 Chronicles, you should always, is this, it gives more detail than you get in than you get in 2 Samuel and in 1 and 2 Kings about these kings, and especially about David and Solomon. You don't have to turn to it now, but when you're reviewing for the final exam, you'll find a section back there under 1 and 2 Samuel on David's men, on the characteristics of David's men, those who came to him at Ziklag, those that came to him at Hebron, and so on. And you'll notice that those are taken from 2 Chronicles. We get beautiful detail on the kind of men that came to follow David. You get insights in the life of David and the experiences of David that you do not get in detail in 2 Samuel. In 1 Samuel, well, 1 or 2 Samuel. And then you also get details concerning some of the kings of Judah. I would strongly encourage you to read, for instance, in the 2 Chronicles, chapters 26 to 32. And that is concerning Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. If you want just a list of those names, it's in the first verse of the first chapter of Isaiah. You remember? That Isaiah prophesied through those kings. He just got started at the end of King Uzziah. You all remember Isaiah chapter 6, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and lifted up. Okay, he started at the end of Uzziah's reign, and he goes right through to Hezekiah. And they alternated, be sort of good and bad. Uzziah wasn't too great, Jotham was pretty good, Ahaz was terrible, and Hezekiah was great. So you want to chart it on a graph, it just looks like a W sort of thing, or an M, just up and down. And this is in detail in 26 to 32. Then in chapters 34 to 35, you get detail on Josiah. Remember that good king that brought about the various revivals and so on. So I'd encourage you to read those chapters, especially in 2 Chronicles. All right, now, also on the same page of the notes, I'd just like to underscore a few things here that might precipitate a few comments that would be helpful. The relation of the exile to 1st and 2nd Chronicles. There's several points to notice here. First of all, there was a remnant of 50,000 had returned from Babylon to the Judean region where Jerusalem and the temple lay in ruins. So you've got only a small group of all of the Jews living at that time who actually come back to the land. But they had come back, so there's a Jewish presence back there. Not like it was before. A new era had begun, the times of the Gentiles. And there you find a description of the times of the Gentiles. Jerusalem would be under Gentile control. And the nub of that is, the essence of it, is that there is no king on the line of David on the throne. Only a small proportion of the Jews are back in the land. Most Jews were of the diaspora, or diaspora, all over the world from Persia west. Now this was a brand new movement of Jews. Let's just back up in history now and see where we're coming from. At one time, there were only 70 descendants of Abraham's family. Just 70. They weren't called Jews at that time, as we know. They were just the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They go down, by God's guidance with the Joseph thing and so on, they go down as 70 people to Egypt. They stay there for nearly 400 years and turn into a group of 2.5 million slaves with no governmental structure whatsoever. They were great at agriculture, and they weren't too bad at bricks either. Agriculture and bricks. Okay. They were brought out by a miracle. They were given a law, a constitution, a leader, a government, a religion. They were given everything they needed to exist as God's people on earth. And after an interlude of 38 years when they missed their way up at Kadesh Barnea, they came around, the next generation, and they came into the land and they possessed the land. Now what I'm trying to show is that for practical purposes, every descendant of Abraham was at that moment living in the land. And they stayed in the land. And they didn't go any other place. They had some traders go down, you know, to the Ophir and bring back the ivory and the apes and all that sort of thing. But they're just traders. They lived in the land. They were located in the land. And the land was extremely important in the Abrahamic promise. They were in the land when they were right with God. Then they were warned by the prophets for years, for about 300 years, that their idolatry was going to take them off the land. Well, as we know, in 722, the capital of the northern kingdom, Samaria, was destroyed after siege, and they were scattered. The Assyrians took the 10 northern tribes off. By this time, as you know, Simeon had been absorbed into Judah. And then Judah was alone. And then then they came over and they destroyed a lot of the people of Judah, as we've just seen. And then a remnant of Judah was taken over. So what I'm getting at is that for practical purposes, there were hardly any of the descendants of Abraham left in the land. And the largest group of them existent at that time were in Babylon, over at the Euphrates River. Then the decree of Cyrus says, you can go home now. But only 50,000 came back, so that you have a minority in the land. Now what happens? What happens to the rest of them? The rest of them, and this is the turning point in history for the nation Israel, they are no longer a nation, they are a race. There are people, and many of them stay there, and they turn from agriculture to commerce and industry and business. I don't mean GM trucks when I say industry. I'm talking about other kinds of industry. But they become the skilled craftsmen. They become the bankers. They become the entrepreneurs. They become the salesmen. They become the leaders of finance and commerce, and they move up to Russia. They move to East Europe. They move all across the Mediterranean area. Some of them move down to Alexandria, and as I've mentioned before in this course, 2/5 of the whole city of Alexandria were descendants of Abraham, called Jews at that time. They move on up, and they move out with the explorers. They move to the New World eventually, until we have this diaspora scattered all over. And there are far, far, far many more Jews outside of the land than have ever been inside the land ever since 586 B.C. That's the diaspora. Now, when the Apostle Paul was ministering, he went first to the synagogues and so on. But even at the time of Jesus, only a fraction of the Jews at that time were living in the land. And so it has been ever since. And it wasn't until the turn of this century that Jews started to come back into the land in a serious way. And now there are about 2.5 to 3 million Jews living in Israel. And now, for the first time since 586 BC, really, we have a strong issue as to who owns the land. What right do they have to be back in there? There was no question up till 586, but after, and then they moved on out. There were hassles. There we'll see the Maccabean revolt of 167 BC and so on. But the Romans took over in 63 BC, Julius Caesar to keep them calm. And Paul went out, as we've seen, and ministered to Jews around, but that was the diaspora. This diaspora then becomes very important, and tie it back to the time of the exile, because they didn't return from it. Most of them didn't. And that next point, of course, ties into that. There was no king after Zedekiah, as we've seen. The high priest was a de facto head of the nation. There was no temple after its destruction. There was a need, therefore, to rebuild a temple. They built a small one, but it was nothing like the former days. But there was a need to retrace all of their religious history and the background of the temple in order for it to be accepted by them at that time. There was no capital city. Jerusalem had to be rebuilt, a much smaller Jerusalem. Zerubbabel did this. And then the walls had to be rebuilt. They didn't happen at the same time. It took place nearly 100 years apart. And so the conclusion is that a whole new historical record needed to be written to meet the needs of that generation in that new situation. And that is why we have 1st and 2nd Chronicles, in addition to the books of Samuel and of Kings. Notice the exile in Babylon, the conditions of the exile. I think most people are rather vague on this. They think, oh, well, just like the Egyptian time when they're down there making bricks. Not at all. At first, there was oppression because Nebuchadnezzar was pretty angry with the way they'd acted. But later on, the Jews became colonists, not slaves. And as you see on the map that goes with this section with Ezra, they had a whole section called Tel Aviv, and it was on this Kibar, this canal that went from one part of the Euphrates to another. So in many respects, where they lived in the exile in Babylon was very parallel to the kind of land, flat land, they lived in Goshen back in Egypt. The only thing was they never had to make bricks. And there was, after the first little bit, there was no oppression. And there was no pharaoh that said all the male children have to be killed. They multiplied. They had freedom. They went into town. They learned the language. And after 70 years, their kids and grandkids couldn't speak Hebrew. And so they picked up the language of the people. They learned Aramaic, the language of Babylon. And when they came back to Judah under Zerubbabel, they didn't speak Hebrew anymore. They came back speaking Aramaic. And they kept on speaking Aramaic. And so when Jesus went to school, they taught him not in Hebrew, but in Aramaic, which was the language of Babylon brought back with them. They even were allowed self-government. There was a very interesting development at that time, and that was the synagogues. Now, we don't have solid evidence that these began at the time of the exile, but there's strong inferential evidence. Do you remember how important it was in the land that they all go to one place, to Jerusalem, to worship? You remember how verboten it was to worship any other place? That's fine if you've got a temple, but what if you don't have a temple? What if you don't have an altar? What if you're off down in the flat land between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers? They're developed gathering places, little gathering places, almost like ethnic welfare halls in some large cities where the Poles of a certain block area would gather, and the Russians would gather, and the Romanians would gather, or the Italians, or whatever, you know? You don't know what I'm talking about. Okay, I can tell you some place to go. You know what I'm talking about. Where they would have maybe their weddings. Of course, they have a lot of them in church, but in that kind of situation. But they would have their social events and so on. It was a gathering place. It was a rallying point. And the Greek word soon means together or with. And ago, the verb, means to gather, and synagoge is simply gathering together with. It was the gathering together with place. So synagogue simply means the gathering place, the meeting place. And they had one of these, two of these, three of these, four of these, and they had worship services. They didn't offer any sacrifices because there was no altar in them. But they read the law. They sang the psalms. They had somebody give a little exhortation on one of them. They went through various ceremonies, and you'd be amazed that if you study the synagogue service at the time of Jesus and the morning service that you probably went to last Sunday morning at 11 o'clock, about 9/10 of the items are just about the same. I don't know where they took the offering, or they probably didn't have faith promise plans, but they do very much. That developed in the exile when they're over there without any temple. That's the point. So synagogues. And by the time of Jesus, we're told, I'm not sure for the facts, but we're told that there were 500 synagogues in the Jerusalem area, and in all of Palestine at the time of Jesus, there were 1,500 synagogues. And all you needed to have a synagogue was 10 men. Unfortunately, it didn't matter how many ladies you had, but you had to have 10 men. You had to have a minion. If you got 10 men, you could have a synagogue, you could have a service. Well, you can read about the various results there. Now, look on the chart on page 5, if you will, please, for a moment. You may want to add a date or so into there. But across the top, you've got Assyria. And Assyria really came to great power at the time it defeated Syria. That was its first big conquest. And it controlled the whole of that Fertile Crescent right down to 612. The capital of Assyria was Nineveh. And in 612, the Babylonians took Nineveh, so that was the end of that. From then on, we have the Babylonians in control. They don't control things very long, because in 539, Cyrus comes in and destroys Babylon. He doesn't actually destroy it, by the way. He leaves most of it. There was a large element within Babylon that were unhappy with the present king. They didn't like his theology, literally. They didn't like the gods he worshipped. He'd gone away from the old gods, and he worshipped some new gods. And so they didn't like him. So a lot of them were very happy to see Cyrus come in. Cyrus came in, and the Persians, therefore, take control. And there are five kings of the Persians as we go along down through history. And they are eventually taken over in 323, well, actually before that, in 331, the Battle of Arbela, the Greeks take them over. So the next empire is the Greek, but that's off the end of the Old Testament, so we don't have it in there. Looking back, you'll notice a few of the key events. Sennacherib attacks Jerusalem in 701. That's after he had taken Samaria, and he almost took Jerusalem, but didn't. That's when Hezekiah and Isaiah opposed him and trusted God for deliverance. And then Jerusalem was conquered by Nebuchadnezzar after he had conquered the king of the Pharaoh of Egypt, the Battle of Carchemish. And then Jerusalem is destroyed, actually 586, as I mentioned. And Zerubbabel comes back in 537. The temple gets started in 536. And we'll see in our study of Ezra that they'd just gotten the thing started and they had to stop it. And the reason they had to stop it was that there was opposition. There was a real problem. And actually, Cyrus didn't live very long after that. And his successor actually stopped it. And then finally, in 520, it was restarted. And it was restarted because of two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah. And Haggai and Zechariah just got to preaching, and they said, hey, guys, we're not going to let this thing sit like this. It's important that we build a temple. Now, of course, we know that God doesn't live in churches and temples. And if we build a glass cathedral, he's no more likely to be there than he is in some little chapel somewhere. So that this is not a big issue with us. But it was a big issue with them because the worship of God was seen to be localized for the basic purpose of emphasizing monotheism, that there was one God, one place. Now, I haven't heard any Americans say, well, if you have several churches around, you must have several gods. Nobody ever thinks that way. But they thought that way in the Middle East at that time because gods were located at various places. This was the problem with them. And so the temple was completed in 516, and then during the reign of Xerxes, we have Esther, the book of Esther. And then Ezra himself comes on the scene in 458 and comes back to beautify the temple. And finally in 444, 445, Nehemiah does some work in building the walls. Now, I want you to keep that in front of you, sort of, to follow the pattern of the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. And these next few days now, we'll be getting to Ezra and then Nehemiah. And you'll see where the book of Esther fits in. We do Ezra and Nehemiah. We leave out Esther for the moment because Esther fits in the middle of the book of Ezra, as you'll see.